The first reading this morning comes from the pen of Gary Kowalski, a Unitarian Universalist minister and author, whose seven-year-old book, Science and the Search for God, is, in my opinion, a modern classic, and I highly recommend it. The great theologian that he mentions, Charles Hartshorne, or I should say Hartshorne, it's spelled like it should be pronounced Hartshorne, but it's Hartshorne, was an active member of our congregation in Austin, Texas. He died 10 years ago at the age of 103. He and I used to exchange letters now and then.
In his autobiography, Charles Hartshorne relates an early religious experience that took place when he was a soldier stationed in France during the First World War. Alone, in an isolated spot, the young man liked to sit and think. "I began thinking of certain aspects of my life that seemed discouraging," remembers Hartshorne. "These gloomy reflections were interrupted by shrill sounds. Looking to his left, he saw a school playground filled with shouting, laughing children. The contrast was enlightening. So my own life is unsatisfactory," he thought. "I am but a tiny fragment of human life. The rest of it is not all wretched." "And since then," wrote Hartshorne, "I have two convictions. One, that there is some good and some minimal beauty in all life, including my own. And two, what finally matters to me is the life of the whole. The something that includes me, outlasts me, and contains more good than I can imagine."
And the second reading is a poem, The Pattern, by poet Janet Holmes, written some 16 years ago. The only thing I removed from the poem for the public reading of it were three phrases of such scientific difficulty that to explain them would take the better part of a half an hour, so I decided to use the part of the poem that could be immediately accessible.
Imperfect memory. Snowflakes creating themselves in their own image never get it exactly right. So what you end up with are all these approximations. This many points, that much filigree betwixt, but no matched pairs. The same with leaves, their veins and serrate edges. The same with smoke. The wisps from 20 identical votive candles at the shrine are not identical. They remember only a general way of rising, curling, fading. What do you want? Patterns that make you utter surprise. Non-linear plots, fractile repetitions, a white winter landscape. It's perfect peace. Wood fires coiling up the chimney this year, as in all others. In the spring, the leaves coming out fleshy and soft on the branches, as if on cue. No two are alike. You want a miracle that knows its place, when to be explicable and when. Your daughter first stretching her mouth into a grin you recognize as yours, an utter surprise.
Thank you.
I don't know how or where or when you reflect on the deeper meanings and questions of life. But for me, it's almost always at night, alone, when I wake up unable to sleep. It happens here in Columbus 2 or 3 nights a week. And it happens when I'm up in Sterling Heights, Michigan, where my father is in the slow and difficult process of dying. When I went up there last week, it was because we all thought his end was near. It turns out he was accidentally over-medicated. And so by the time I got up there, he had begun to settle back into his long struggle. But while I was up there, when I woke up in the middle of the night, as I always do, my father in the next room began to start singing. That's right, he was singing there in his hospital bed at 3:30 in the morning. He seemed to be making up a song about the days of the week. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. This is a man, mind you, who has never sung. We never had music in the house when I was growing up. We never listened to it on the radio. The singing of music, of songs, was simply not in our family regimen. Now here is my father singing, making up, it would appear, both sequence of words and melody. But it got to me, this singing. It's one of the ways I think that he is reflecting on his life, the whole 89-year length of it. Perhaps this is his present way of remarking about how fast life has gone by. Almost 9 decades gone in a snap. When he was lucid, he always used to say things like that. He used to remark how fast the days of life have passed by. But in the middle of that same night when my father was singing, and even though I am not presently on my deathbed, I reflected on the mystery of my own life in my own very different way. I started to think of and imagine the streets that I've walked in various cities, where I've lived, where I visited, the shape of the gables with sun on them in the late afternoon, the sunsets that I've worshipped over land and sea, the conversations I've had with those I adore as friends. I think of my failures, my struggles, my triumphs, and I think especially of all those with whom, once upon a time, I fell madly in love. And then I think of how these intimate, shining things flash by so quickly on this earth. And I think of how surprising it is that every single moment of my life is the fruit of thousands of millions of years of evolutionary struggle. And I think of the awful majesty of that struggle. Whole species dying off, comets striking the earth, new species developing, plagues, sharp teeth. And this whole procession has led precisely to this intimate moment, you hearing my words from behind a pulpit fronted with a beautiful woven cloth, my mouth speaking them under this wooden pyramid. Yes, this wooden pyramid, standing over land once forested and traversed by native peoples whose names for themselves we don't even know. This wooden pyramid, rising over land once covered entirely by water, or thundering under the awful clawed feet of armored reptiles. This wooden pyramid, which is located on one small part of this vast planet, which itself is but a small blue dot in space. We are but the tiniest fragment of the whole, a million million galaxies, 1,000 billion stars squared, scattered across the abyss like beach sand. What does John Adams say in the affirmation? Though I am but an atom in the universe. And there in the middle of the night, me, a mere atom in the universe, whether in Columbus or Sterling Heights, Michigan, or Paris for that matter, doesn't make any difference where, I am astonished that the whole pageant of evolution results in me, results in you, results in the flashingly brief life of that Olympic luge athlete, Nodar Kumaratashvili, killed on his course, or the much longer life of philosopher Charles Hartshorne, who died at the age of 103. Such astonishment late at night is the whole ground and whole source of all of my spiritual and religious life. I am reminded of the astonishment experienced by Hartshorne as he compared his sad life to the laughing schoolchildren on the French coast during his military stint in the First World War. Recognizing that the lives of those playful children and his own war-burdened life were inextricably joined, he was able to write, I now have two convictions. One, that there is some good, some minimal beauty in all life, including my own. And two, what finally matters to me is the life of the whole. The something, capital S, that includes me, outlasts me, and contains more good than I can imagine. The life of the whole, a very clean English phrase that might serve to summarize in all simplicity the vast panorama of cosmic evolution that leads up to this very moment. Now, my understanding of cosmology and evolution does not come from me being a scientist. I have not personally studied Precambrian fossils, worked with carbon dating mechanisms, or studied Hubble photographs with advanced computer analysis. I have not dabbled in the DNA of ancestral lemurs, or researched the awesome development of the human eye from mere eye spots on the face of some ancient salamander. I was simply taught about evolution, the evolution of species, and the Big Bang in grade school by nuns. It was just a fact akin to the assertion that water turns to ice at a certain temperature, and Mars is the fourth planet rotating around the sun. I was also taught many other things by the nuns, namely that Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead, and that the mere touch of the shadow of a sainted priest in France, Jean Vianney, restored sight to a blind person. These stories are not meaningful to my present religious awareness, nor do I think they are literally convincing as actual facts, or even if such facts happen, that they would mean anything religiously or spiritually to me. But these stories were of an entirely different character than the teachings of evolution that I received as a child. The teachings of evolution were based on the long, ever-improving observations and questions of thousands of men and women who did not know everything once and for all, but were discovering incrementally, step by step. And the patterns they found in the developing story of what Hartshorne calls the life of the whole were just that, approximate patterns, not finalities. Flow, not forever. There was a time, for example, when there were no mammals like us on this earth. They gradually developed over millions of years. The earliest horse, Aohippus, was the size of a terrier. The present horse that we all know, Equus, is a great deal larger than a terrier, you all know. Those changes happened over a great deal of time. And of course, in time to come, the present horse, Equus, may look quite a bit different than it does now. For evolution is not history. It's part of the present and all of the future of our whole, of our universe. For example, millions and millions of years from now, evolutionary think tanks have extrapolated that creatures related to the present squid in our seas will roam over the land as earth animals. And that was totally surprising to me when I first heard it. But our poet Janet Holmes says something about surprise being hidden in all of the evolving patterns of the world, all of the patterns of similarity and difference, of expectation and surprise, she outlined in her lovely poem with reference to snowflakes and leaves and smoke. Each snowflake is totally different from each other, and yet they are all clearly recognizable as snowflakes. Each curl of smoke from a votive candle clearly distinct. Yet clearly, she says, they remember only a general way of rising, curling, and fading. And then look at us, human beings. Even the most identical twins in the world that exist are not really entirely the same. And amongst us here, colors of hair, eye and skin, height, weight, hair texture, nose size, hand and foot size, skin tone, muscle definition and shape. What variety? And yet clearly we're all human. The mother in the poem recognizes that it's her own smile that's shining out of her daughter's face. But she does not think that daughter and mother have suddenly become one person. No, she delights in the sheer miraculous surprise of recognizing the genetic materials that give shape to her smile cruising through the next generation. She is delighting in the evolutionary flow forward of which she and her daughter are merely parts, parts of one stupendous whole. I spent a little time this week exploring the anti-evolution sites on the internet. Lots of sound and fury there, to be sure. Real rage. Terror, even. Terror that Darwin's great theory is unveiling itself as the only real alternative for explaining the origin of species. On the other side of the coin, I read article after article by evolutionists about how the human eye developed. Sadly, I encountered a verifiable story about how one evolution scientist actually misreported his results. Certainly a misdemeanor in the world of silent science, and it certainly made the anti-evolution crowd really happy. But by and large, the misdemeanors and even outright lies erupt from the anti-evolution crowd. The distortions I came across this week were breathtaking in their bald-faced use of innuendo and manipulation. It saddened me. But still, since I am not a scientist, much of the vocabulary engaged in these articles was simply opaque to me. And since I am emotionally in a state of upheaval and grief because of my family's sadness up north, I was not able to find much focused strength to bring to you this morning triumphant research discoveries as part of this sermon, evidences of evolution that would just dazzle you. But no matter. As I said earlier, my acceptance of evolution as the way of the world, the way it works, is not based on my own personal scientific studies. Unlike the Unitarian minister Joseph Priestley, I am not even an amateur scientist. And I don't accept evolution as the way of the world because, as critics opine, people like me have placed some sort of quasi-religious faith in the affirmations of Darwin instead of the great designer. Although I do indeed have a great deal of faith in human beings in general, and some human beings in particular, I am not caught up in some stupid contest between religious faith in the Almighty versus religious faith in the human Darwin, although that's the way irrational thinkers like Ann Coulter parse the issue. No, my whole affirmation of the evolutionary understanding of life comes from my inward experience. Experiences that I have had in the middle of the night that are similar, parallel to what Hartshorn experienced in France with the playing children that reminded him that he was part of the life of the whole. It's the experience I have when I wake up in the middle of the night and watch the snowflakes falling outside my window across the dark parking lot, knowing that none of them are the same, but that they're all snowflakes nonetheless. Part of the general pattern of creativity and innovation that makes the universe what it is, and you and I what we are, flowing along the course of life for a while, then yielding to the future that, in Hartshorn's words, outlasts us. As my father lies struggling on his hospice bed, alternately singing and punching at his attendants, he is closer to his end than I am, presumably. I don't know what he imagines about that. He won't talk to me about such things. But there is not a day that goes by, or a night, that I am unaware of the quick succession of my own days and the swift gift of life and how grateful I am to be alive and to be part of the evolving life of the whole right now, this day, this moment, this breath. You want a miracle that knows its place, writes the poet Janet Holmes in answer to her question, what do you want? You want a miracle that knows its place. When to be explicable, all those fossils and research grants. And when, she adds, when she recognizes her own smile in her daughter's face, it's an utter surprise. At night, when I stand looking out the window, or listening to my father sing and fight, I am surprised. And that brief apprehension of the life of the whole is, frankly, all the miracle I need.